I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the gloves are off in the Republican presidential race as the candidates get ready for their debate tonight in Florida. But first.
Hamesha, Pakistan Fauj ka. Aam yo nasiro.
Pervez Musharraf blinked back tears and often struggled to maintain his composure as he said goodbye to his troops and stepped down as Pakistan's military leader today. The move fulfills a key opposition demand a day before Musharraf is to be sworn in as civilian president. He still has to contend with former prime ministers and current opposition leaders, Benazir Bhutto and the recently returned Nawaz Sharif. Sharif was deposed when Musharraf took power in a coup in 1999. Shahan Mufti is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us from Islamabad. Shahan, first of all, were you surprised at how emotional this was today?
Well, Robin, like you said, it was quite an emotional moment. This has not really ever happened before where a military chief of the army has stepped down, choosing to be a civilian leader rather than a military leader. So this has made history in ways in Pakistan, and people are expecting the opposition to get involved and also for things to change maybe in the coming days.
Well, you mentioned the opposition. The two former prime ministers, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, are the key opposition leaders. Do they accept Musharraf as president? As we said, that's supposed to take place in the coming days, but is it a guarantee that that's going to happen and that they accept that?
But Pervez Musharraf's presidency and his eligibility to be president is really a matter that the opposition is not addressing at this point. This is a matter that they would address if their other demands of lifting of the emergency and especially reinstating the judiciary happens. Once that happens, they may very well take this case up of Musharraf's eligibility again with the same old Supreme Court.
Well, and let's remind people, Musharraf has freed many of those detained in the past few weeks. Most of the major news operations are once again operating, but there is still a state of emergency. And as you said, members of the judiciary, specifically the former Supreme Court that he sacked, are still under house arrest. Is that likely because the Supreme Court that was sacked was replaced with supporters of Musharraf who cleared the way for him to become president? Is it likely that he's going to reinstate the old Supreme Court?
This is very central, Robin. The Supreme Court that has cleared Pervez Musharraf last week to become president is a Supreme Court that the opposition does not recognize as the true Supreme Court, is what they say. The Supreme Court that Musharraf removed had demonstrated itself to be more independent and more aggressive in checking the executive's power than any other Supreme Court has ever been in Pakistan's history. That did scare a lot of people, especially Pervez Musharraf and the military. But this one specific demand of reinstating the judiciary would almost mean political suicide for him, and it is very unlikely that he will give in to that demand.
Meanwhile, this is all happening ahead of January's scheduled parliamentary elections. It's not clear whether the opposition leaders will boycott, although they are registered as candidates. It's not clear whether Benazir Bhutto will continue a sort of power-sharing agreement with Musharraf, which is how she returned to the country in the first place. But in the meantime, Musharraf's successor as head of Pakistan's military is General Kayani. He was once head of the ISI intelligence agency, but also Benazir Bhutto's military secretary in the late 80s. So is it expected, you know, that he'll continue along the same sort of pro-Western path, or what are the thoughts about his leadership?
His political outlook in Pakistan might be different, what role he wants the army to play in civil and political life in Pakistan. His general politics go as far as the war on terror is concerned. Many expect him to continue along the lines of Pervez Musharraf.
Meanwhile, Shahan, one last thought. Do you think Musharraf's emotional departure from the military today, you know, in tears, do you think that's going to endear him to the average Pakistani, or is that going to, you know, somewhat emasculate him? Will he be seen as sort of bowing to Western forces?
Pervez Musharraf was a very popular leader when he first came in. It's really in the last year that he has really accumulated all this baggage, which is weighing him down now. It doesn't seem that it will win him any allies in the opposition, obviously, because it's demonstrated that he's now in a weaker position than he was. He does not have the explicit support of the military, who he's always dependent on for most of his power. So I think his tears may have been tears of sadness, but in a way they might have also demonstrated that Pervez Musharraf is not the powerful man that he was before this.
Shahan Mufti, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Well, with 5 or so weeks until the voters go to the polls in New Hampshire and Iowa, and following a week of back-and-forth accusations, the Republican presidential candidates take to the stage tonight in St. Petersburg, Florida, for the CNN YouTube Republican debate. More than 5,000 questions have already been submitted to YouTube.
As a Republican, you're supposed to stand for smaller government, privacy. We've lost our civil liberties. The Patriot Act is an outrage. What are you going to do to return the civil liberties to the American people?
As a gay Republican, a term many in my own party deem to be an oxymoron, how do you suppose I, and others such as myself, go about making our party a larger and more open tent?
My husband is self-employed. If you are elected president, how do you intend to make insurance both affordable and accessible to all Americans?
Well, the candidates will answer questions from YouTubers, but more likely more from each other. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani says Mitt Romney has to explain stories of violent crime in the state he formerly governed, Massachusetts. Romney has just released a brochure questioning Giuliani, Senator John McCain, and former Senator Fred Thompson on their stance on gay marriage. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, closing on Mitt Romney's lead in Iowa, has put out a TV ad referring to himself as the Christian leader in capital letters, seeming to underscore Romney's Mormonism. Congressman Tom Tancredo is arguing he's the candidate concerned about core issues like immigration and national security. And Ron Paul continues to rake in the money online, with his numbers rising in Iowa faster than they are nationally. So, in advance of tonight's debate, we welcome Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. Kay, welcome as always.
Good day.
And Josh Rogers, political correspondent for New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, welcome to you as well.
How are you?
We're just fine. And Kay, I think it's safe to say there's been a shift. There's going to be a little more heat tonight.
Correct. I mean, we saw a little bit of that heat played here in Iowa over the past 24 hours. Rudy Giuliani had not accepted the Des Moines Register's invitation to debate in the middle of December. It will be the last time Republican candidates share the same stage, and Iowa voters will have a chance here to look at them. And in the statement that was released accepting that kind invitation, there were a few unkind words said about unnamed rivals, people who didn't have a record of cutting taxes and controlling government waste. So the game is on here, as it has been in New Hampshire.
And just remind us, you know, why people say Republicans are now acting like Democrats, because this is new to have so wide open a race for Republicans.
It is. Traditionally, Republicans have at least paid lip service and some fealty to, Ronald Reagan's sort of commandment, thou shalt not criticize other Republicans. It's, become rather spirited, particularly with Mayor Giuliani and Governor Romney when they were campaigning here last weekend. It was just kind of tit for tat all weekend long on topics, ranging from taxes and spending to the situation with the judge in Massachusetts to family values.
Well, let's pick up that situation. And Kay, if you don't mind, I'm just going to outline it, because I think people in other parts of the country might not be familiar. As we are here in Massachusetts, we're reading about it every day. This is a situation where Romney, as governor, appointed a Democratic judge said to be tough on law and order. Later, she, Judge Kathy Tutman, released convicted killer Daniel Tavares after his 16 years served for killing his mother. But even though prosecution wanted him held on charges of assaulting jail guards, he allegedly then fled to Washington State, allegedly killed a young couple there. Now, officials here in Massachusetts are saying this is much more complicated than on face value. There were systematic problems in the judicial system outside of any judge's decision. But, Josh, what is Giuliani saying?
Well, saying that that Mitt Romney has to explain this situation, but more broadly that he has to explain what Giuliani claims is a bad record on crime. And, citing crime statistics is always dicey. It's difficult to report on them generally, but he cites statistics saying that, crime went up during the time that Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts. The Romney camp has countered with statistics that say that crime has gone down, although their statistics don't take out murder and rape, but it seems that the statistics, overall crime pretty much held steady during Mitt Romney's time as governor.
Well, Kay, it has the whiff of the Willie Horton story of the Michael Dukakis campaign. Is it resonating out there as much as, that story certainly did?
No, it isn't. But I would say that Mitt Romney has been in the crosshairs of all of his rivals in Iowa for months and months. I'm reminded of something Mike Huckabee said about Governor Romney at the Iowa straw poll. on the night of the Iowa straw poll, when, of course, Huckabee came in a surprising second, he said that Iowans understand that they're buying the cereal and not the box, that it's more than just the packaging, it's what's inside. And so Governor Romney here has been challenged in regards to his stand on social issues and his performance as governor on those particular issues. So he's been in the limelight in terms of his record as governor of Massachusetts for months here.
Well, let's take a look at Iowa, because the big news there, Mike Huckabee, seemingly out of nowhere, a former governor but also a Southern Baptist minister, rising in the polls neck and neck with Mitt Romney. Is it just that, as we said, you know, Mike Huckabee is perceived as the Christian candidate and there are questions about Romney's Mormonism? And what else do you attribute this surge to?
Well, A, Iowans are late deciders. B, I think Iowa social conservatives were waiting to see what kind of a candidate Fred Thompson might be. He has not spent much time in Iowa. Therefore, I think social conservatives have begun to coalesce around the former governor of Arkansas. I will tell you that back in early October, I attended the Iowa Christian Alliance banquet. It was a very interesting evening. This is a group which used to be called the Christian Coalition in Iowa. They held a huge banquet, had about 800 people there. And Fred Thompson and his wife stood at the front of the banquet line as everyone walked through and shook their hands as if they were sort of a married couple at their own reception. But as I talked with all the people who were in that banquet line, they were Huckabee supporters. So to those of us who've been out here covering these candidates, it's not surprising to us that Huckabee is catching fire. Right. It was always a surprise to us that Huckabee wasn't doing better in the polls heretofore.
Right. We spoke on our program to a Christian homeschooler, thousands of them in Iowa throwing their weight behind Huckabee, not just because of Mitt Romney's Mormonism, but because of his, they perceive he switched stance on, you know, gay rights and abortion. But Josh, I just want to bring you back in for one second. We're going to take a break, but we mentioned Fred Thompson and that question, what kind of candidate he was going to be. What are they saying in New Hampshire? What kind of candidate has he turned out to be?
Well, people aren't saying much because he hasn't been here, and when he has been here, it's been pretty lackluster. He's been here three times. He's never really made a compelling argument, at least according to the voters that I've talked to, about why he's necessarily in the race, what alternative he's providing. And, you know, he's been dogged by this reputation that he's lazy, and he doesn't act in a way that that would disabuse anyone of that notion.
Well, that is Josh Rogers of New Hampshire Public Radio. We're also talking to Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa. Ahead of tonight's debate in Florida, the Republicans getting together, and some say it's going to be, well, fireworks we haven't seen in the past. We're going to take a little break and come back to talk about the other candidates, John McCain, Tom Tancredo, Ron Paul, the other issues, immigration, sanctuary cities, health care. So you guys stay right there. We're going to do that. And don't forget later, take a look at Zimbabwe. Fighting AIDS is a big problem, not just to bring medical supplies, but to bring food. People are starving. We'll have that story later as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking Republican presidential candidates ahead of tonight's debate, the CNN YouTube debate. We're speaking with Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, and Josh Rogers, political correspondent for New Hampshire Public Radio, just north of us here in Massachusetts. And I want to ask you both first, before we bring up some topics, what are you hearing out on the trail, Kay? What are people asking about in Iowa? What's on their minds?
Well, among Republican voters, they're sort of equally split. There was an American Hospital Association survey that was conducted last month, and it showed that about a quarter of Republicans are concerned about immigration, a quarter are concerned about health care, a quarter are concerned about terrorism and the war on terror and national security, and the other quarter are concerned about fiscal issues, taxes, government spending. So I think that's why you're seeing the campaign debate focus on those issues among Republicans in a way that it hasn't among Democrats. Democrats have been, you know, really focused on the health care issue of late.
Right.
The other fascinating thing in Iowa is that these Republican candidates haven't spent much time here. For all that we've said about Mike Huckabee's rise, the last time he was in Iowa was on November 8th. Mitt Romney and Fred Thompson were here a couple of days before Thanksgiving, but November has been pretty devoid of Republican candidate visits.
Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think they're sort of switching their sights to New Hampshire, or do you think that Republicans think they have Iowa wrapped up? You know, there's been a lot of talk about the farm subsidies, especially ethanol, and a lot of them going to Iowa. Why do you think they're not paying as much attention?
Well, I think the reason is that Giuliani has started to, give some signals that New Hampshire is a state which he hopes to sort of take a stand in. He's never spent much time in Iowa and has sort of run a non-traditional campaign, spending a lot of time on commercial talk radio stations that, by the way, carry Rush Limbaugh, as opposed to spending actual time meeting with Iowans. So I think that's why the shift has gone there, because I think candidates see in New Hampshire a place where maybe John McCain could put something together and, you know, throw the same kind of surprise that he did in 2000. John McCain has not spent a good deal of time in Iowa either.
And well, Josh Rogers, John McCain won a major upset victory in New Hampshire in 2000 against then-candidate George W. Bush. How is he faring?
Well, I think he's been climbing back into the mix. I mean, he was basically left for dead this summer, as you may recall, when his campaign sort of imploded and they basically went into the red. He did win big here. People hold him in high regard. If you look at polls here that ask the question of, you know, sort of which candidate most shares New Hampshire values, you know, his numbers are the best, and you know he also rates highest when the question is who tells voters what they truly believe rather than what they think they want to hear. You know, he is essentially blowing off Iowa, and he's made that pretty plain. But the thing is, here voters, independents can vote on either side, and independents were crucial to his defeat of President Bush back in 2000, and they're going to be, you know, crucial for him this time. And so, you know, we'll see. And since he's not going to be in Iowa, he's going to be around here, and he'll have a chance to make his case.
Well, you know, we mentioned the issue of immigration, which John McCain took a lot of, you know, heat on, and Tom Tancredo is claiming as his own. It seemed to center recently on the issue of sanctuary cities with then-New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. We've been hearing the tape of him as mayor seeming to welcome illegal immigrants to his city. And then he's turned around and said that Mitt Romney, when he was governor, sat by silently while some cities here became sanctuary cities for immigrants. How is that issue resonating out there? Sanctuary cities in particular, Josh, you hearing that?
Well, you hear it invoked a lot, and it's hard to know how much the average voter really thinks about sanctuary cities versus illegal immigration in general. And it's also a top issue in New Hampshire among the GOP electorate, certainly. And you hear a lot of talk, both candidates have their points against the other, but I don't think that sanctuary cities in particular is going to sway any voters any more than just immigration in general, which, you know, it's surprising to me how high that rates among Republican voters here. I mean, it's essentially their second priority after the war. And, you know, but one thing that I have in talking to voters here, one thing that you hear a lot of is concerns about electability, which was something that Democrats talked about last time around. And this time it's a lot of Republicans, you know, they want to make sure that they have someone who they think can prevail in the general election, particularly in that a lot of Republicans are envisioning Hillary Clinton as being their opponent.
Kay, I just want to ask, you know, some of the other candidates, Duncan Hunter of California, Alan Keyes, we mentioned Tom Tancredo. But Ron Paul is the candidate who seems to have the most signs. He's been raising an amazing amount of money online. His message is "Get out of Iraq now." What is he? You know, how is he considered? Is he considered a candidate who's going to stay in the race or who's going to drop out after these debates go along? I mean, how's he seen in Iowa?
Well, actually, I had a chance to sit down and talk with the congressman about 10 days ago, and I asked him whether, if he's unsuccessful in winning the Republican nomination, if he might run as a third-party candidate, because he certainly has a core of very committed supporters, particularly folks online. And he said, gosh, no, he's done that before. As you recall, he was the Libertarian Party's candidate in 1988. He said he spent half of his money just trying to get his name on the ballot in states. And so if his train does not go all the way to the Republican nomination, he has no intention of running as a third-party candidate this time around.
But what is he saying that's so resonating with people? I've traveled across the country, and, you know, the signs are up.
it's not, I don't think it's the war message. I think it's the economic message. Many of the people that I see at his rallies and who email me, I would, I guess, have to admit profanity-laced email, they're very concerned about the economy. And it's his currency crisis message, his fiscal conservatism, that I think is really plumbing the depths of the economic despair that many Americans feel. I mean, we've got a housing mortgage crisis, you know, other economic problems looming on the horizon. And there are people who are really interested in his message about the gold standard.
That's Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa. And we've also been speaking with Josh Rogers of New Hampshire Public Radio. They're both weighing in on the Republican presidential candidates who take to the stage tonight in the CNN YouTube debate. It's supposedly going to be a hot one, so we'll all be watching. We want to thank you both for giving us this primer. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead today, the sound of mating season from Moose Country. What do you hear up in Maine? But first, the news. Back in about 6 minutes here and now. Zimbabwe's autocratic ruler, Robert Mugabe, has thrown a planned Europe-Africa summit into confusion after saying this week that he will attend. The British, among others, today threatened to withdraw from the talks if Mugabe shows up. Well, we want to look at how the situation Mugabe created in Zimbabwe is affecting health care. Just 3 years ago, the Luisa Guidotti Hospital in Zimbabwe was treating about 600 AIDS patients. Today, that number has grown to 1,500 AIDS patients in a country where water systems are contaminated and food and fuel are hard to come by. Zimbabwe has one of the world's highest rates of HIV infection, with over a fifth of all adults carrying the virus. Dr. Carlos Magnoli is in charge of the AIDS control program at the Guidotti Hospital in Zimbabwe. He was recently in Boston to attend a fundraiser with the Roberto Bazzoni charity, which funds his hospital. I spoke with him then. The HIV rate in Zimbabwe has fallen down to a fifth of all adults.
Yeah.
So that is relatively good news, but put that in context for us.
Yes, please. It is relatively good news. There has been a lot of education going on, particularly in the schools. And it may be that a lot of youth now are regarding sexual activity with more care than before. But it has to be said that also the prevalence has decreased because of the increased number of deaths due to AIDS.
So the number of AIDS patients has gone down because they've been dying.
Many of them have been dying.
Of course, when we think of Zimbabwe now, we think of a country in tatters. Draconian laws, a dictator, Robert Mugabe, as a result of some of his policies, like the seizure of farmlands held by white farmers. The country's gone from a breadbasket to a place where thousands have fled. Thousands are surviving on handouts. So how is that affecting your work with AIDS?
Terribly. You realize that an AIDS patient is a very critically ill patient, and he needs a lot of support in terms of good food, and particularly protein food, you know. And then in a situation where agriculture is not producing anymore, and even there are no more cows or animal husbandry whatsoever, they can't get enough food to survive. So even if you give them the proper drugs, the antiretrovirals, they may not survive, they succumb.
So are you finding yourself in the business of helping to find food?
Definitely. One of the tasks of our charity in the last 2 years has been to provide food to the patients, and on top of that, to provide food for the staff of our hospital and other centers related to it, because they need also food for them and for their families.
We understand there's a porridge, satsa in particular, that's eaten by people in the country, and its delivery has been stopped?
Satsa is the main staple food that is made with maize flour. Unfortunately, there is not enough production in the country. It has to be imported with foreign currency, but then the distribution is a monopoly of the party in power. So they don't allow any other operator to do a distribution of that kind.
Given the trouble getting, you know, what we would consider a basic, you know, food or water, we understand, you know, hospital workers are looking for boreholes to find water. You're nodding yes. Well, then how hard is it to get things that are often hard to get, like medicines?
Yeah. To get medicines is the least of our problems now, because thanks to the charity, we get them straight away from the producer in India. But now the main struggle is to get food enough locally, because the production has gone down. We try to get, for example, cooking oil made with soya, soya cake, maize flour, beans, sugar beans, and we find it increasingly difficult.
But the medicines that you are getting, are these generic medicines?
Yeah, they're the generic drugs which have revolutionized the treatment of patients in Africa because they are low cost and very effective.
So this has been good for you?
Yeah, excellent.
Is it a government that also, as in neighboring South Africa, is ambivalent about the science behind your work?
The government in South Africa is much more ambivalent than the Zimbabwe government, because the Zimbabwe government has always accepted the dire situation of the epidemic in the country, while the South African government has always denied it.
This is fascinating that you're saying for all the problems in Zimbabwe with this dictator Mugabe, you actually are having better luck lowering the AIDS rate than South Africa, which is so sophisticated.
It is a fact. We have never been hampered directly in starting the first antiretroviral treatment program, which was ours in 2002. We have never been obstructed by the government. They don't give us help, but they don't obstruct our work.
I want to just ask you briefly about the charity that has helped you out, and you're here for one of their fundraisers. It's the Roberto Bazzoni Onlus. We understand that means charity?
It means charity, a non-profit.
And it was named after a young man who actually died in a plane crash.
Roberto was the first son of Mr. Sebastiano Bazzoni, who is the president of the charity. He died near Pristina in Kosovo during a humanitarian operation. He was a physiotherapist and he was there starting a project of medical assistance to the victims of the war.
And now this charity that is named after him has helped you so much in your work. But what do you say to people when you come to the States? As you said, Zimbabwe, the AIDS number is dropping. How do you compel people? You know, there's, as you well know, there's sort of a burnout on AIDS. People are looking at Darfur. They're thinking of helping refugees from Iraq. How do you bring them to consider AIDS patients in Zimbabwe?
Yes, we are focusing mainly on children and on mothers, you know, because in the mass of patients, which are probably now about 500,000 people needing treatment in Zimbabwe right now, only 60,000 are receiving treatment. And we lose
only 60,000 out of 500,000.
Out of 500,000. We decided from the very beginning to help particularly the staff of our hospital, those who are already sick, staff of other hospitals, nurses, because without the nurses we can't work and help the patients.
So you're having to treat the staff of the hospital for AIDS.
Definitely. That was the first step of our program.
Yeah.
Definitely, because without them we couldn't treat the others. And they flocked in after a period of denial because nobody wanted to be tested before the treatments were made available. Because if they were tested positive, they knew they will die. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to be tested. And then the second step was to start working on children, because there are very many. You know, 30% of the children born from a seropositive mother are, unfortunately, AIDS patients. And then mothers. We concentrate on mothers because in the African society, more than in any other society, women are the pillars of society. And if we make them die, they will leave behind a sea of orphans. So if we save a mother, we can save at least 10 children, because there will be the children of that particular mother, which will be cared for by the surviving mother on treatment. And then there are the children of sisters and brothers who have already died from AIDS.
That she was taking care of.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a common experience in Zimbabwe. You know, you can imagine that with $200 we can treat a patient for 1 year. 10 times less than it was 7 years ago.
Dr. Carlos Spagnoli, director of Luisa Guidotti Hospital in Makoto, Zimbabwe. He's in Boston fundraising with the Roberto Bazzoni charity. Dr. Spagnoli, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin. It was a pleasure.
Okay, before we go today, Sandra Boynton and Davy Jones, the illustrator and the monkey. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, here in New England, thoughts are turning to sipping hot chocolate, huddling round the fire. For Moose, that means rutting. They just grew new antlers to replace the ones that fell off in the winter. They're rubbing the velvet covering off on trees because it's mating season. Matt Tinker is a guide with the Green Farm Guide Service in Copland Plantation, Maine. He takes people out to try to catch a glimpse of the moose during mating season. Matt, first of all, what are the signs from the moose?
You know, the big signs are the rubbing on the trees. You know, you'll find little strands of velvet on the trees. And the velvet is the soft, fuzzy covering that covers the antlers as they grow throughout the summer. Also, as you're walking along, you'll find the wallows, places where the moose have kind of scraped on the ground, and essentially the bulls and the cows both will urinate in it, and they'll roll all around in it. They'll try to attract each other. You know, the pheromones are going. If you're walking through the woods, it's a very, very, very strong smell. You can often smell it much before you find it. Also, as you're walking along early in the morning, just before light or just after dark, quite often when it's very quiet, you can hear the moose calling.
Actually, you not only hear them call, but you call back. Do you have your birch bark horn there?
I sure do.
Okay, now I know there's different ways you can talk to a moose. Can you illustrate for us the call that you might give? And first of all, tell us what it means during mating season.
Well, during mating season, you know, the first call you might want to give is the easiest call to give is the, hey, where are you? You know, the bull moose, he's really looking for a cow moose, and he's kind of saying, you know, what's going on? They're very, very quiet when they call.
Right.
All right, here we go, the bull moose. Pretty exciting, huh?
That's like a snort.
So he's walking around making that noise, and the female, she's out there, and she's going to make a really nice long call. Here we go. That's basically, where are you? I'm really looking forward to finding you.
Okay, now when you go out and take people, you also use wet rawhide. Now, what sound is that?
Sure, with wet rawhide, basically what you do is you take like a 32-ounce bean can, just put a little hole in the bottom of it, and you run some rawhide, say a piece about 2 feet long through it. But the key thing is you wet the rawhide. And with the rawhide, essentially you just pull it gently.
Okay.
And you can give it a short little pull, and moose have several different sounds. There's kind of a little, oh, like, hey, what you doing?
Yeah.
And then there's longer mating sounds. And, you know, with the can call, you can produce several different sounds. So we'll give a couple of those a try.
Okay. You know, a question for you.
Sure.
I mean, who doesn't love moose? They're such glorious beasts. Don't they deserve a little privacy, Matt, at this time of year?
Well, one thing that I tell folks when we're out there is, you know, nothing beats live bait. So we're in a blind and we're calling and all of a sudden Bullwinkle comes in and then you hear a snap in the woods behind you. And the female moose comes out. She looks at us, looks at him, and walks off. He looks at us, looks at her, and he walks off as well. So, yeah, they have plenty of privacy on their own. You know, you can only trick them so much, and it comes at a certain point where, you know, the actual live moose is always going
to
win.
And by the way, just what's it like when you spot one? Because they're hard to spot, and you do need to keep your distance, you know. Don't get between a mother and her child, all that stuff. But what's it like when you see one? You know, do you ever tire of it?
Oh, I never tire of it. I'm excited every time I see it, and I always wonder, oh, is that a moose that I might have seen before? And if it's not, I'm really trying to get a good look at him or her and check him right out and everything. And it's really exciting every time you see it. You know, a little silly story, a quick story.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to be out there sometimes and calling. And, you know, the first time when you bring folks out there and you're calling and you let loose with one of those, where are you? Everybody has a little giggle.
They scare them away.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Matt Tinker is a guide with the Green Farm Guide Service in Copland Plantation, Maine. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Sounds like Chewbacca from Star Wars, doesn't it? The Wookiees. They may be showing up in Maine, for all we know. When we come back, Davy Jones and Sandra Boynton, Here and Now. illustrator and author Sandra Boynton is best known for her lively children's books with friendly hippos, penguins, and pigs in fantastically silly scenarios. In books like Hey, Wake Up, The Barnyard Dance, and Moo Ba La La La, the stories are told in sing-song prose, and sometimes the characters just plain sing. That's because Sandra Boynton is also a talented songwriter, and she's now out with her fourth combination book CD set. It's called Blue Moo, 17 jukebox hits from way back never.
Have you ever heard a sound, a melancholy air, so distant you might wonder if it's really even there? It's something so simple and something so true, the magic of the blue, blue moon.
That's the title song, Blue Moo, performed by the legendary Steve Lawrence. Sandra also lined up Brian Wilson, Neil Sedaka, Davy Jones, formerly of the Monkees and Broadway. We're going to speak with him in a moment, but first, Sandra Boynton joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, your three previous albums have sold more than 500,000 copies each. You produced them all with your musical partner and neighbor, Michael Forbe. And on Blue Moo, most of them are performed by many former teen idols. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, this jukebox era music is from the 50s and 60s. And when I started working on these songs with Mike, I very much wanted that sound. So they're new songs that sound as if they're back from then. And it occurred to me, why not get the original singers from the era to do that? Davy Jones and Neil Sedaka and Steve Lawrence, Brian Wilson. So that was the idea behind it. And luckily, they all said yes. So it was an amazing experience to work with these people in the studio.
Well, you mentioned Davy Jones. He's one of the performers. Let's just listen first to the song he performs, Personal Penguin.
I want to be your personal penguin. I want to walk right by your side. I want to be your personal penguin. I want to travel with you far and wide. Wherever you go, I'll go there too. Here and there and everywhere and always with you. I want to be your personal penguin from now on.
It's right up there with Last Train to Clarksville, and Davy Jones joins us on the line from Florida. Davy, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be in company with both of you beautiful ladies, Robin, Sandra. Oh, my goodness.
Why did you say yes? Did you know?
I'll tell you one thing, because it's my kids. I have four daughters, and when I mentioned Sandra Boynton's name, they said, you know, delightful. It's adorable. You know, Dad, we play it to the kids all the time. And I got credibility all of a sudden. They come to see me when I perform, and, you know, I do many shows. And they say, Dad, we don't get it. We just don't get it, you know. And finally they get it.
A whole new generation will now know Davy Jones.
I think so. And, you know, to be in the same company as people like, you know, Neil Sedaka and Brian Wilson and Bobby V. And not only that, there is a group on the album called The Sparklets. One of the young ladies is Sandra's daughter.
You know what, David? We've got The Sparklets here. Let's listen. It's a young girl group with one of Sandra's daughters in the middle. Let's listen.
Tell me, have you heard a sound sad and far away? Maybe it is calling you, but who can ever say yay?
And Sandra, you know, it occurs to me that what you've done here, it's so multi-generational, and it's going to delight not just the kids as they read along, but the parents as they have the memories. And Davy, with that in mind, I just have to make a full disclosure here. It wasn't just Marcia Brady that headed a Davy Jones fan club. Prior to the Monkees, you were an acclaimed Broadway actor, the Artful Dodger in Broadway's Oliver. You probably remember the former president of the New York chapter of the Davy Jones fan club. You had to talk to me at the stage door frequently. I was like 10, and I had to consult with you at the stage door of Oliver. Actually, in fact, that's why I went to see the Beatles at the Ed Sullivan Show, because as an office holder in your fan club.
Yeah, in 1964, I
that's
performed
right.
on the Ed Sullivan Show.
And you gave some of us from your fan club tickets. We'd come to see you, Davy Jones, in scenes from Oliver And then the Beatles were also there as well, which
was
fine.
Well, you know, I used to be a heartthrob. Now I'm a coronary. But you're talking at this particular point. I honestly, Sandra, I'm getting requests for my personal penguin.
Oh, are you? Oh, that's
it's
great.
It's scaring me. It's scaring me.
I'm amazed, though. It's wonderful that Robin was the president of your fan club when she was 10. Robin, that's a wonderful, wonderful story.
I love that in your concerts, people are, you know, crying out for, you know, your personal penguin. And Sandra, I was online. I couldn't believe it. The video of Davy Jones performing My Personal Penguin. It's wonderful, but it's also had thousands of hits. You know, a whole new generation is checking it out. We want to listen to just a couple more songs. B.B. King did one for you. It's called One Shoe Blues. Let's listen.
Well, I woke up this morning, couldn't find my shoe. Yes, I woke up this morning, and I couldn't find my shoe.
Sandra Boynton, working now with B.B. King, Davy Jones, and of course doing your illustrations as well. In fact, the Norman Rockwell Museum is planning a retrospective of your work to tour the country in 2009. Your thoughts on, you know, you started out with greeting cards.
I'm a very lucky person. I love what I do. I love the people I work with. Never in my life did I think I'd be working with Davy Jones or Brian Wilson or the great B.B. King. Having so much fun.
So, Sandra, let me ask you, do you ever think and put together, you know, Christmas time or birthday time, do you illustrate and send personal sort of like greeting cards? You know, a personal like card. I'm into letters. I write letters.
Davy Jones, I think you're angling for a Christmas card from Sandra Boynton.
I would honestly love it. I would love to have it. It would just be a personal treasure on the mantelpiece, you know.
Sandra?
But, absolutely.
I mean, you must sketch a lot and do stuff.
I draw a lot, yes. No, you've got it, Davy. You can have a personal penguin card for Christmas.
Oh, this is going to be good. I'm going to be taking this at Christmas time to Santa Barbara to my kids and showing them. I really know her.
Well, now that I have my own signed Davy Jones tambourine, my own tambourine has been signed by Davy Jones. It says, Sandra, peace and love, Davy Jones. And I go, oh, my goodness. My life is now complete.
Sandra gave me a beautiful, beautiful sweater, and it had a D on it, because this was what happened during the, you know, 60s, and, you know, when you were going out with somebody and you had a crush or wherever. And I wonder if, you know, we are now instigating through Sandra's works that kind of remembrance, that kind of occasion that seems to, maybe it's me and I'm getting a little older and I'm looking back and thinking, well, I had so many happy memories and so many memories of different occasions that were, you know, similar to a lot of people's experiences.
Well, I think that's why this work is resonating so much.
I think so, too.
That's Davy Jones, formerly of the Monkees, of course, of Broadway, and now of a Sandra Boynton book. He's featured in Blue Moo, 17 Jukebox Hits from Way Back Never. Sandra Boynton, of course, children's author, illustrator, song producer. Her new album CD set, Blue Moo. Sandra, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I've had a great time.
And Davy, thanks to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'll tell you one thing. I'm definitely going to be part of my Christmas stocking gift.
Davy, thank you.
Okay, all the best.
Twice as nice, I wanna be your personal penguin. I want to walk right by your side. I want to be your personal penguin. I want to travel with you far and wide. Wherever you go, I'll go there too. Here and there and everywhere and always with you. Please may I be your personal penguin. Imagine me, your personal penguin. I wanna